Inspired by the nice talk we had yesterday, which was, do we live in five dimensions? So I'd like to ask a somewhat easier version of that question, which is, does the spin spirals phenomena live in one dimension? And the speaker yesterday joked that whenever the title of a talk is a question, the answer is always no. So keep that in mind. And the other question I'd like to ask is, assuming this is the case, why is the field-induced transition first order in these systems? I should explain, this is at t equals zero in a pure system. It's so-called, sometimes called a dimer to incommensurate transition. So maybe I'll just comment on the extent to which people have tried to model spin spirals phenomena by one-dimensional models and comment on the extent to which they seem to either work or not work. Real materials, and then this sort of naturally leads into the second question, which is sort of related to this problem. So, it seems like I get the impression there's maybe sort of almost two groups here. There's one group of us anyway that are a bunch of reductionists, and we're always trying to reduce everything to the simplest possible model, and we're especially happy if our models are one-dimensional, because then we can solve them numerically or maybe using one-dimensional field theory methods. I think work on the spin spirals phenomena is a good case in point of this approach. So I guess the model, kind of model that most people would really like to be studying would probably be a model with three-dimensional phonons coupled to quasi-one-dimensional, three-dimensional phonons plus quasi-one-dimensional spins. So I just write this to emphasize that it may be legitimate in a material like copper germinate to consider the magnetic interactions to be primarily along the chains and to ignore interchain magnetic interactions. But unfortunately, it's clearly a lousy approximation to pretend that the phonons are one-dimensional. And I just remind you, if we had a material where the elastic couplings were one-dimensional, it would sort of fall apart into be like a one-dimensional version of graphite where sort of layers peeling off, you'd have chains coming off, and that certainly doesn't seem to be the case in copper germinate. So in these systems, we're really dealing with elastic interactions, which are quite three-dimensional, but magnetic interactions that may be quite one-dimensional. And then the question is, can we deal with this using one-dimensional models? So there have been various approaches. In fact, I want to mention and sort of contrast three different approaches that people have been using. And it's not quite clear the extent to which any of these are really very successful.
If it comes to excitations, spin excitations, and the question of if the system is really one-dimensional, would you still say that copper germinate is one-dimensional?
I think it's not clear. I want to touch on exactly that point. In fact, I want to mention there are three types of one-dimensional models people have been using. They make various predictions about the excitations, and it's not actually clear that any of these, well, the extent to which any of these are really correct is not at all clear, so which is sort of the point I wanted to mention. So,
I got a question for copper germinate. I didn't know what the electron photon couplings are.
Spin phonon couplings?
Yeah,
I don't remember the numbers offhand. It's probably fair to say they have to be fairly strong or you wouldn't get a spin spirals effect in the first place. Do you have a number handy?
Those of us who don't know the copper germinate, you just sketch what it looks like and what it does.
Boy, that's really a hard question. Yeah. This thing's not plugged in, I guess. Thanks.
The amount of dimerization is still disputed very much.
You're talking about Marcus Garvey.
No, I mean, dimerization is just the alternation of the change factor. That is not normal.
I think, yeah, in this is
So Claudius has handed me this graph, if that helps.
We know that that's a good structure, so...
I see the reductionists are starting to lose here.
So we have the change of one dimension, well, more or less one dimensional kappa ion. The weakly linked, that's the two dimensional aspect via the main impression oxygen to the other chain, but everything is buggered here. So the next layer is pretty decoupled. And so the key issue is that the oxygen is now not in between the kappa ions, but there's an nearly 90 degree angle. And actually, this arrow is the opposite. That's wrong. So what happens is this point goes up and this goes in, and they go together, and this one goes out. And that's
okay.
Thanks.
So, I have a feeling a lot of people here probably know this, but maybe just remind you what the models are people are considering. So one model which gets used a lot is it's an effective one-dimensional model where we only have the spins around, not the phonons. And this is often referred to as adiabatic approximation. So the idea here is to regard the, of course, in the spin pyrrhos effect, we're concerned with lattice distortion and how this interacts with magnetic exchange. So in the so-called adiabatic approximation, it's assumed that the lattice cannot respond on the time scale of magnetic fluctuations, so one considers a lattice distortion to be frozen in. So if you have a frozen in lattice distortion, so that the spins couple more strongly in every second link, then corresponding effective Hamiltonian is usually written something like this, and then plus some sort of delta squared over two terms. So this represents elastic energy. This represents the change in the exchange interaction due to the lattice distortion. And then the parameter delta is usually determined self-consistently by minimizing the ground state energy. But in this approach, one basically regards the lattice distortion as being frozen in trying to calculate excitations.
And instead of the usual Pauls story, where it's electrons that are doing the dimerization, here is the spinning.
Here's the spins. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. So from this point of view, what drives the transition is the fact that the ground state energy responds in a singular way to a distortion, and that's connected with the tendency to form dimer. Singlets. So this is often referred to as a model with explicit dimerization.
So in this approximation, you don't know whether phonons is
two-dimensional. Yes, so this approximation, you're kind of not worrying about phonon dynamics at all, so it doesn't matter very much. Yeah, so here you might get a one-dimensional model just because the... So I should say the idea would be this is valid if the phonon frequencies are small compared to, for example, the energy gap in the spin system, which is induced by the dimerization. So in this limit, it probably doesn't matter very much if the phonons are three-dimensional or one-dimensional because they're not playing much of a role in this picture.
So for the organic materials, is this a good model?
Probably less than the gap induced by delta, which is going to be smaller than J, in fact. For copper germinate, I think estimates are it's probably not true. And I'm not sure if it's true for anything, actually.
Well, it's probably essentially always a good approximation at low temperatures and far from any critical field that would destroy the dimerization. Because you have your dimerization caused by whatever phonons you like, and then at low temperatures, far from any transition, then you're probably a good approximation.
That's not so clear to me, right? I mean, if the phonon frequency is to the energy scales for the magnetism, I don't really see why. You can ignore it.
You will have some between phonons and the negative excitation signs that are the same energy state.
Yeah,
that's okay. Get the other speakers up here too. Sorry, this is
in the phonon frequencies, there are four pipes at the phonon mode, and the NFC
is also degrees. Okay.
Well, it's more or less. It's
150 Kelvin and 300 Kelvin. The two phonons.
More or less, not exactly. Yeah.
But the gap is much smaller.
But the gap is just.
But somebody asked that question.
Yeah. And see, the gap is about 20 degrees.
Oh yeah, the gap delta is.
Kelvin.
Kelvin.
300 Kelvin. Call Kelvin.
3J.
Oh, J.
3J.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's more or less what he's saying. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's most people's impression, that the energy scales are roughly similar here.
And this talk about what kind of phonons along the
number, I think, yeah. I can just with this picture, one of the systems or the picture of the
phonon. So anyway, that's one type of approximation, which is probably not, in fact, very good for copper germanium, maybe not for other some pyrrolus materials either, for that matter. There's another approximation, which is it's a more interesting model, but it probably also it's clearly not valid for, well, it's probably never valid also. Another model is just a purely one-dimensional spin phonon system. So it's a numerical work in this model, but it probably doesn't describe any real system. Again, this would only be valid in the limit where there are no elastic couplings between chains, which is never, I mean, sort of a fun model to play with, but that's probably not going to describe any real system. So it may be some strange polymer system or something where the polymers are completely decoupled. So this model, but this is still an interesting model to consider in any event.
So you're saying it's worse than A?
Or? Yeah, I mean, the limit in which this would apply is different than the limit in which that would apply, but they're both probably terrible. Yeah, this is, well, actually, it's not quite clear. Let me come back to this point.
Okay.
In fact, C to some extent combines these two, but it's not clear any of these are very good. So, so in this model, in fact, typically one considers, for example, just one-dimensional Einstein oscillators coupled to a single spin chain. So this model has no explicit dimerization. The Hamiltonian is completely translationally invariant. So what happens here is basically delta gets replaced. Delta becomes a dynamical variable, which is different on each link, and it basically becomes the if AI is a phonon creation operator on site I, or a lattice displacement operator. So it's a quantized lattice displacement operator on site I in this model, and one often takes for simplicity just Einstein model for the phonons. So this model is completely translational invariant, but what it exhibits is so-called spontaneous dimerization. Well, you can have one sitting in each link, or in other words, yeah. I mean, a better model, I guess, would be to just, I mean, that's a detail, but yeah, just have a displacement from each site, right, and have some energy, yeah. So this model has so-called spontaneous dimerization, and what's believed to happen in these models, at least for some range of parameters, is that the model can spontaneously go into a dimerized ground state. But of course, in this case, there are two ground states that have exactly the same energy. So the system has to actually break a symmetry to choose one ground state or the other, over the other. This is probably a good place to mention. I'll come back to the properties of this model in a minute. And then finally, there's a model which, for example, was promoted by Daniel Humsky and collaborators recently, which is a model where we basically take B And then we add sort of weak interchain elastic couplings, which are treated in a kind of mean field theory. So the idea here is to treat the interchain elastic couplings in a kind of mean field theory, and this basically means that delta comes back. So a classical delta is back in the game. And must be determined self-consistently. So this model basically has both explicit plus spontaneous dimerization. Because the one-dimensional model has both a delta, which is a fixed classical number, and it also has a delta, which is a quantum variable, namely representing one-dimensional phonons. Yeah, I mean, I should say, in all of these approaches, one always has some self-consistent step. So any classical delta is always determined self-consistently. That's right.
Still a spontaneous model where you have two ground states which can be shifted by one light spacing.
Yeah, but I guess I'm emphasizing that from the point of view of calculating dynamics in the model, there's a serious issue of which parameters are taken to be classical and which ones are taken to be dynamical. So then I just wanted to mention some of the predictions of these models and how they fit with experiment. I'm probably already out of time, at least especially as far as... So let's just talk about the excitation spectrum. So in model A, it's known, well, at least field theory predictions say that the excitations consist of a triplet and a singlet. At least in the limit delta goes to zero. The gaps for these things, the scale is delta to the two-thirds. And there's this nice prediction that the ratio of the gap of the singlet to the gap of the triplet is supposed to be square root of 3. This actually comes from mapping this onto the Sein-Gordon quantum field theory. I should say there have been some efforts to verify this numerically. In fact, including by Kamp, who I guess he's not here today. Maybe he's not here. Anyway, in fact, this is not... Efforts to verify this numerically have actually failed, but I think it's just because they're large logarithmic corrections. So I think this is actually would be the case in this model. Perhaps strangely, this prediction seems to agree quite well with experiments.
So you would say that, I don't know, say that you have to from critical point to alpha
I think the problem is just that in general, this thing is multiplied by a scaling function of basically the gap times the length, and also depends on the effective marginal coupling constant at scale L. And it's basically a nightmare to try to do the finite size scaling. You would probably need very, very large chains to be able to verify this. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's almost impossible to verify this with chains that are shorter than about 1,000 numerically.
What does it mean that delta goes to zero?
Sorry, which delta? There's two deltas here. Yes, so I mean, so it's the limit where delta goes to zero is a limit where the gap becomes very small compared to J. And in that limit, it maps onto the Sein-Gordon quantum field theory. And one has this nice prediction from the Sein-Gordon model.
You consider doing sort of a purely doubtful effort to try to mimic this finite-size scaling?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. Experimentally, you might not expect. I think there are many reasons why. I kind of suspect this root 3 was actually seen in experiments, but I kind of suspect it was just some kind of a fluke. I don't really believe the reason it was seen was because this model applies, actually. So.
Okay.
Yeah. This holds up to a if you add a second nearest neighbor coupling. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
This should hold up to the critical coupling J2 over J1 of about. Yeah. That's what I call model A as long as you're in that region. So there's no spontaneous dimerization. In model B, where we have purely a one-dimensional spin phonon model, the excitations are purely solitons, spin and a half solitons. And this has been tested by numerical work, and this actually follows from other general principles, that whenever you have a spontaneously broken discrete symmetry in one dimension, you'll always have solitons in the spectrum. And in this case, it seems to follow from topological arguments that the soliton should have spin and half. So the soliton is just a defect separating these two different ground states, and it's sort of guaranteed to have spin and half. And this seems to be true in spin phonon models or frustrated models or any models in one dimension, I think, where one has a broken discrete symmetry. Numerical work indicates that the solitons repel each other. They don't want to form bound states. So if you calculated the spin structure function S of Q of omega, you just see a two-soliton continuum. There would be no discrete spectrum. Which is not seen in experiments. Finally, model C, one takes dynamical one-dimensional phonons and puts in small explicit dimerization. And then what happens is the solitons form bound states. Due to interchain effects, yeah. And this is really this Konski et al. Idea. So they draw these nice pictures. So the physical picture they have is so here's a dimerization pattern on a bunch of neighboring chains. And then if you put in a soliton here, for example, or let's say put it in here, then we get a region and then another anti-soliton here. Then we get, and they're separated by some distance x. Then we have a mismatch of the, have a kind of elastic mismatch of the lattice distortions over the range of the chain in between the soliton and the anti-soliton. So we effectively have a linear potential which grows like x. Now if we quantize the system, let these solitons vibrate around, they form bound states in this potential. And the number of bound states actually grows without limit as the strength of linear potential gets weaker. So this linear potential basically involves the some sort of interchain elastic coupling energy. So if the interchain energy gets small, this linear potential gets very flat, and the number of bound states gets larger and larger. So there's a simple way of testing in a real material how close you are to this limit being valid. You should see a very large number of singlet and triplet ground states if you're in the regime where the system is behaving like weakly coupled one-dimensional chains. I emphasize there's no reason a priori when any system should behave this way because, as I said, elastic couplings are not usually weaker in the third dimension, than second and third dimension than in the first. And again, we should see a large number of triplets and singlets. In experiments so far, I've only seen one triplet and one singlet. So I would take this as an indication this model, in fact, is not working very well either.
I mean, it's largely very principle
to
case A, right? I guess
case A, well, it's true they saw something close to root 3. But there's no obvious reason why case A should apply either, so.
Why is that? I mean, I would sort of think that the problem is really just two-dimensional, that the assertion that delta is purely classical to see what the small correction about it should be.
Sort of a qualitative level, I guess it should work, but there. Whether one can regard the excitations as being sort of decoupled magnetic excitations
is not so clear.
Oh, in this region, one gets a much more complicated spectrum. There's not just one delta. There's a bunch of different gaps. There's many triplets.
Small delta.
Oh,
so, I mean,
yeah.
Mapping effect, I mean, you were saying...
Yeah, there's also, there's a delta that comes in here as well. So there's some kind of a self-persistently determined delta. But it's going to depend on the...
How does this vary, I mean, between the solitons and the long chain? I mean, in this...
No, in this kind of mean field approach, delta is just taken to be fixed. And it just represents this is some mismatch energy.
Okay.
Which
might be the case for solid monadic, where the epsilon lambda is getting more than one excitation.
Oh, I see. I wasn't aware of that. That's exciting. How many have they seen?
Only one excitation seen in this.
Yeah, I think there's one triplet seen in neutron scattering and one singlet seen in Raman scattering only. And the ratio looks fairly close to root 3.
All these three models are the same compound.
No, they're quite general.
Well,
but
okay, but the copper germinate would be a candidate for all these
yes,
models.
Yeah.
Now, it seems that you have two problems, well, two different things. One is the model.
Yeah.
And then you have the technology of how to solve the model.
Right.
And you kind of mix
Well,
both things when you try... To go to the experimental
sure,
the
sure.
Experiment,
yeah.
Both are one.
Yeah.
Which of the three?
I mean, I think we understand how to solve these three one-dimensional models fairly well, with some minor arguments about a few points.
So one of the three is better in, compared to the other one?
Well, Model A seems to fit this prediction about the spectrum quite well, but it's not clear, I would say, why it applies, based on looking at energies.
Isn't the case that the issue whether the solution of these models should be tested against numerical
sure.
calculations, not experiments? Experiments is a separate...
Yeah.
This is mostly numerical.
But the trouble is that there aren't any good numerical simulations of three-dimensional spin phonon models. It's too hard a problem to do numerically. That's the other problem. So most of the numerical work has been in these, either model A, B, or C. So one is sort of left trying to compare to experiment, but as you say, that can be a bit dangerous. I think you might get lucky with one number. Anyway, I've probably used up far too much time. I was going to make a few comments about the finite field transition. Maybe I should wait till the end, or?
My feeling is that maybe we can also continue this discussion next week. So,
But let me start before you. The goal there, when you say these models are good or bad, the goal is to try to describe in quantitative detail the spectrum above the gap.
Yeah, or say neutron scattering, cross section, or Raman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, experiments. Yeah.
What is your opinion about having more than one dimension of spin models? Because the integration of phonons, you can have more complicated integration spin coupling.
Yes,
what
that's
true.
That's a nice way of looking at it. So you might, I guess, integrating on phonons, you're going to induce couplings to the form. S's and T's are the spins on different chains. And you're going to induce sort of dimer-dimer couplings. Right. So you could argue these are quite large. Also, it's another possible way of looking at it. So the magnetism may only be quasi-one-dimensional in the sense that the Heisenberg couplings are predominantly one-dimensional, but these dimer-dimer couplings could be quite large. So I guess I won't take more time to discuss magnetization, but let me just say that all of these models predict a continuous transition. As you know, all the one-dimensional models, at least the simple-minded one-dimensional models where the mean field coupling is taken to be purely of this form, they all seem to predict a continuous transition as a function of field, where basically what happens is kind of a Bose condensation. So in Model A, you kind of Bose condense spin 1 magnons into the system, and because they repel each other, the magnetization grows with a characteristic square root singularity as you increase the field. Or in, I think when you get solitons, what happens is you just sort of condense these solitons into the system, and again they seem to repel each other, and again you get a square root singularity with a different amplitude because you're condensing spin and half particles instead of spin 1. Experimentally, they seem to see a first order transition, and again it's presumably connected with the interchain couplings that aren't treated correctly somehow in these simple-minded one-dimensional models. So Dr. Mueller-Hartmann, for example, and others have pointed out that if you take more general types of one-dimensional models where you kind of self-consistently vary this classical parameter such that it's not just oscillating at wave vector pi, but oscillating at an incommensurate wave vector, then you can obtain the right behavior. But I was going to make a few comments about, from a more physical point of view, why that might happen, but probably I should stop at this point. I was looking at a recent paper where you obtained first order.
From a point of view of phase transition in general, it could happen that there was at higher temperatures there was a signal of phase transition as well.
You mean as you vary some other parameter?
Would it be generic to also have a second order phase transition like that?
I think it's certainly possible. In fact, maybe I'll just comment. A natural guess is that one might get a kind of a three-dimensional Bose condensation transition. And actually, these spin particle systems are not the only ones in which you get field-induced transitions. They've also been observed in, any system that has a gap, any of these magnetic systems with gaps, magnetic gaps will have transitions when the magnetic field Zeeman energy exactly cancels the gap energy. And two other interesting cases are this copper borate compound, which has this simple dimer ground state. Another one actually was there's a spin ladder compound. There's a recent paper by on thallium copper chloride, which apparently is a two-leg ladder compound which exhibits, it has a gap and exhibits a field-induced transition, which does look like it fits quite well to three-dimensional Bose condensation, as was argued in a very recent preprint by Mikuni and Nishikawa. Thallium, sorry, which, this is thallium copper chloride.
Is any kind of
pyrrole
there, or just...
No, this is just a weakly coupled ladder material.
But no pyrrole.
It doesn't have any pyrroles, that's right. So, yeah, what effect pyrroles has on the nature of this transition is not entirely clear, and possibly... I had some rough idea. Sorry to take so much time. Just desperately trying to think of something original to say during this talk, I had a rough thought about what might be going on here. So in the situation where the transition is continuous, the kind of picture you have is maybe that these dimers on the neighboring chain sort of stay locked into their ground state, and then you start Bose condensing these coupled solitons. So if you imagine a sort of a dilute gas of these soliton, any soliton pairs that start condensing into the system while the dimerization of the neighboring chains remains rigid, this kind of naturally leads you to this continuous transition picture. But what might happen instead is that instead of this happening, it might be favorable instead to actually produce an entire domain wall. So this seems to correspond more naturally, I think, to the first order transition picture. It's probably more like what happens in the experiments. So maybe the problem here is in the sense that these solitons are attracting each other between chains. And that could probably spoil the Bose condensation transition because I think you want your bosons to have repulsive interactions to get a nice continuous Bose condensation transition. And if they're sort of attracting in the second and third dimension, maybe it changes the nature of the transition.
And why should the first order transition not simply occur because you have to shift the phonons to a different, wave vector?
Yeah, I think that's sort of saying more or less the same thing, right? If you can imagine the neighboring... If you can imagine producing the magnetic excitations on a single chain while the other chains stay kind of frozen in a sort of pre-existing dimerization pattern, then you could naturally get a continuous transition. But if the neighboring chains kind of adjust, which is more like this picture, then it becomes first order. So that these other types of mean field theories are sort of related, I think, to the way the neighboring chains adjust to the creation of magnetic excitations.
Is there any evidence for anything like that?
Yeah, as far as I know, there are also some experiments on some of these organic spin pyrrole systems, and I believe they also see first order transitions of this type.
Well, I mean,
yeah, I mean, this is a so-called incommensurate pattern. So this would correspond to an incommensurate pattern of magnetization, which is what they see in the experiments.
What exactly is the nature of the incommensurate phase? Is there any order normal to the applied magnetic field?
That's a good question. Yeah. I'm not sure.
If you could certainly, Lundy model, you can sort of have
in a strictly 1D model, I guess you couldn't break any continuous symmetries.
No, but you would have power law.
Yeah. In fact, that's what happens. In the 1D models, that's what happens. You get power law, transverse order.
In the experiments,
order.
You might see more range order transverse.
Yes. Order. Yeah. In fact, in the case of the system that exhibits 3D Bose condensation, I think that was observed, yeah. In the case of copper germinate, actually, I'm not sure. They see transverse order?
But that presumably can't happen in the spin phonon model. We haven't put in any couplings that connect the spin orientation in different chains.
Yeah, also I probably should draw these the other way, of course, speaking of magnetic order. Like this. Well, there's also going to be some interchain magnetic coupling, of course. I've joined this. Other thing is, this picture is a bit too simple because the crystal structure in copper germinate has things shifted. Anyway, I should probably stop talking.
When you're looking at four CDVs is like just find a few thing and a couple things through the volume, boom, to say it's first order. So
yeah, they go together. It doesn't have to be structural. I think in the case where we get Bose condensation, I think that the picture is more that these excitations are kind of moving around, they don't lock into a pattern. So
you
could develop some magnetization and maybe some transverse spin order without developing a commensurate order at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's maybe more likely to occur in the case where it's continuous. And the question that sort of goes together, why is it for shorter and why is it structural rather than just being purely mechanical?
But yeah, I mean, even in the weakly coupled one-dimensional model, you will have a hard time making a discontinuous state transition unless you take into account various minima of the quantums, because the number of particles that correspond is zero at the critical field.
Well, I think in a strictly one-dimensional model with phonons, you would probably get a continuous transition. Right?
So I think in all the models you have listed here, and in ladders or frustrated model as well, you get, in fact, I'm sure that you get the continuous space transition.
Right. So what I'm trying to say is the reason it's first order here has to do with the interchain effects and the tendency, I think, of the magnetic excitations to want to line up on memory chains. It could be, but then you get bound states of density instead of the solvent.
So does this thing work here? I had the same problem. Okay. So obviously it's so how much time I will just stay to 10 minutes or so. I'll try to be to 10 minutes or so. I mean, since time has proceeded so far already, I will try to just flash on three view graphs concerning, so to speak, an extension on what we have heard already from the last speaker. So I will just add on top of this the models that we had up here. And I want to focus on the following issue. So we heard already. So the primary issue I want to focus on here is not so very much the spin piles phenomena itself, but I want to add on top of that another issue, another question, so to speak. So the model that I will be focusing on is, so to speak, this more or less number one model with the frustration included. And we have heard much about this model throughout this workshop. So there's just, again, these two alternating couplings, but there is also a next nearest neighbor coupling.
You have here?
Right. So
electrons.
Right.
Now
that's the thing.
We didn't have electrons.
Up to now we didn't have electrons. So that's the second. That's the point, so to speak. I want. Okay. So probably we have seen this phase diagram now for a lot of times throughout this workshop, and we all know that we can put in many of the systems that we have been discussing, so to speak, into this frustration dimerization diagram. I've learned that probably this model is of the diagram now, but okay, and there are many parameters by which you can go into the spin model, like impurity doping, magnetic field, and temperature, and so on, but there's one more parameter, so to speak, that you can add to this diagram, which I think hasn't been focused on too much, and I think it deserves more attention, is namely that you start either doping or at least doing photo emission on some systems like that. So you remove a single particle that can really hop around in the system. So you add, so to speak, that term to the system. So that is what I want to at least briefly focus on here. I might want to extend on that on later occasions when I have a talk here. So why should one be interested in that at all? I mean, why is that an interesting question, or why are we interested in that? I mean, obviously one of the things would be more fundamentally based. So you have two paradigms, like systems which have a quasi-particle weight once the spectrum of excitation gets mass full, and you have the other side of the world, so to speak, when you have no gap in the spin excitation spectrum, you would have vanishing quasi-particle weight. And obviously, between those two worlds where you have a quasi-particle weight and where you don't have one, there are many parameters in this model which you can tune and try to at least somehow come close to that line. I mean, there are the parameters that relate to the magnetic model. There's the question of what happens as you dope to a finite number of holes. And obviously also you can use external parameters like a magnetic field to just make the spectrum massless and maybe get somewhere close to that line. So we want to somehow start here and go in that direction. Right? And I will just grab a very simple issue, namely putting in a single carrier into that system and look at it. Obviously, apart from this more fundamental questions, there's also a rather practical issue about doing such calculations because, I mean, people do such calculations numerically. And here, for example, there's just one figure of Lanczos data that you can obtain on a dimerized chain where people have been putting in single holes and they get one particle spectra out of that. And so we would like to understand how do these spectra actually come about. Okay? Now what...
Perhaps you could
Right. I'm taking model number one. And
you want the electrons now in the game or you
want... I want the electrons...
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Now, when you put that, doesn't that discard the other model, or you're applying it to a certain region which is not applying the other
model?
You don't like the model. Yes, that's fine. But then, I mean, that makes a new physics, which why wasn't taken into account in the first place? I mean, people continue doing this model.
Oh, because if you look at proper dynamics, I mean, you really can, you don't have any fault there. So you can really treat that you have
one for precise. As soon as you dope any pass on course, then you can have the possibility of really having a hoping and it's an insulator. Once you start having carriers moving around, that's what has been
I mean, the experimental question of doing photo emission on such systems is still unsettled. I mean, if you take copper germanate, I've been told by the experimentalists that the surface charge that accumulates while you do photo emission is so large that the thing just blows apart prior to getting any decent data. But that doesn't mean that there may not be other systems which you can do photo emission on. No. They tried to do photo emission. Fink tried to do photo emission.
I guess the experience
is cannot be dope. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know. I don't have to say something about that here at this point, but of course that is something we're interested in also. Obviously. So now, okay, I've used already 5 minutes. I try to continue here. So this is roughly the physics now that comes into play here. We have to put ourselves onto a certain limit that we can treat. The limit that we treat is that of strong dimerization. So in that phase diagram, regarding the spin system, we place ourselves on that line. Okay? And we put in a single carrier into the system. Now what you see here is just, so to speak, a movie of what can happen to the electron once you put it in. So there are like six episodes, and both of them are two pictures. So you put the hole in there, and you have this dimerized background that we were talking about in the last, that we heard from our last speaker. And so this thing can move over here and leave, so to speak, the singlet background in its singlet background. That's the simplest process that you can have. That is elastic. People that are aware of the TJ and one hole story from the HITC, we realize that this is a process which wasn't there. So this, the hole can hop elastically around in the RVD state without doing any inelastic excitation. So there is already some dispersion with the hole without doing inelastic excitations. Now there are other processes where you do have inelastic excitations going around, like for example you can hop the electron, you can hop one electron into that hole and excite a triplet, you can change the direction of the spin of an adjacent triplet, and you can do that either with exchange or hopping terms. So So you can just go through that list of possible processes, and you can account for both nearest and next nearest neighbor hopping terms on just that movie, so to speak. Then you can map the whole system to some coupled spin fermion model. That is something I'm not going to talk about here. I just say we have some means of treating these spin excitations, and we have some fermion that hops around in the system.
I mean, it's one like to take the beta spawn state, and they're sort of dead,
right?
And then you have sort of two things left, which are
right. So you have triplets around. You have triplets around with move, and you have the electrons around which move, and they are coupled by virtue of all these processes.
Spin-offs.
So
these loose states, or they're fine.
And this is what the triplet, so to speak, you excite.
Okay.
No, you're talking about this one here.
Yeah.
Okay, this, yeah, sure, but this, so to speak, stays with the hole. You can talk about, this is the electron, so one electron lives on a bond, so you have one electron living on a bond. So that thing is in a symmetric or an anti-symmetric state. So I rather like to think of that in terms of being the electron or the hole, and that can have two states by parity.
Just for clarity, I mean, you're sitting in that hole A right here.
Right, I'm sitting in model A.
And therefore, you dope with spinels and hodels, I can find the hole, right?
But the magnetic part of the model that I'm discussing, I mean, the spectrum that I have is gapful. So the model that I'm talking about concerning the spin excitations is just you have triplet excitations moving around. They can scatter off, they can form bound states and so on, but in essence the spin spectrum is gapful. And, Okay, so now we have some way of doing these calculations, and I might go into that into detail on some later occasion. I just want to focus now on two effects that will happen with the motion of the hole. One of them is just considering the elastic term here, so the first term of the hopping. That will lead to some bare overall dispersion of the hole in the background. And I just want, this is very simple physics here. It's extremely simple. So the thing is, when you have a dimerized chain, you can essentially have on-bond hopping, and you can have inter-bond hopping in the dimer state. So the hole either moves on the bond, or it moves between bonds. Now, when you have the chain model, the hopping between the bonds, due to the fact that you have a singlet here, changes sign. Because, so to speak, you have to exchange your hole with the minus sign of the singlet that resides on that bond. So the dispersion is already strongly renormalized from the single hole dispersion on just a tight binding model. You get a shift of the order of pi over 2 in the one particle dispersion. So roughly speaking, just the elastic motion of the hole without doing any inelastic excitation looks like a cosine that shifted by pi over 2. So if you compare that with the exact angularization and just look into what is happening with the overall features that you see with the dominant peaks and the exact angularization, this is already explaining more or less the gross features of the spectrum. We don't understand yet where the inelastic parts come from, so where the continuum of excitations comes from. But you can see that you have a tight binding band structure, so to speak, shifted by pi over 2 along the principal axis of the Brillouin zone, and you have two bands. So these are exactly those two bands that you see up here. You can even go one step further with this very simple explanation by looking into what you would see in numerics in terms of the weight of these dominant poles. By doing so, you have to go from these, so to speak, exact states in the dimer representation to what a numerical calculation would do, namely kind of physical superposition of these two states, which gives you a decrease of the spectral weight in the lower band as you go from 0 to pi, and an increase in the spectral weight as you go from 0 to pi in the upper band. That is exactly what you get just from the elastic hopping electron in the dimer state. So the gross features of such kind of a band structure can already be understood simply by one hole hopping elastically on an RBB state. Okay. The second thing about it is that people like to, or tend to think in terms of a whole arm and a spin arm band if it comes to these two dominant peaks. This I would like to argue is not totally clear to me based on these calculations, because these two bandwidths essentially scale with T. Right? So when you look into the literature, people claim that the upper band corresponds to a spin arm and the lower one to a whole arm, or vice versa, depending on which picture you have. But if you look into scaling of the two dispersions, say for two different values of J and T, it's not obvious that the bandwidth of not both of them scales essentially with T. So it's not clear if one of them is really scaling just in terms of J and the other one in terms of T. Okay, so
is delta non-zero? I mean, you're in
delta is non-zero. Which delta? Which delta?
Little delta.
Little delta is non-zero, so the spectrum is gap full.
Then why is there a spin-off?
Well, I'm just citing what. What
then the argument that you put it in the pattern here, you can sort of see the hollow in this field, so it will be a part low.
I'm just referring to the two numerical diagonalization studies that are out on such models, and the way that people tend to explain the spectra. And I'm just citing from these papers that they say, well, the lower one is a spin-on, and the upper one is a hole-on branch.
But they're guessing this or what? Or
right, and so what I'm arguing is that that this is not so. It is very simple to understand this kind of a gross band structure. It's just a single hole hopping on a dimer background.
Yeah, I would sort of tend to argue that, you know, in the asymptote, of course, the spin on hole is confined. So it should be like an electron, mm-hmm. where you put in a lot of energy, right? You can sort of pull them apart. You would see sort of the local hole spin on dynamics. But you were saying that's not the case. But the whole spectral range.
In some sense, yeah.
What happens when scaling
I have with these two bands, right? We have preliminary data on the quasi-particle weight, okay? And I'm going to show that. Now. We have also analyzed this the scaling of the two bands. In our approach, of course, it is such that the dominant features always scale with T, because that is the largest effect, so to speak. But the inelastic scattering strongly broadens and renormalizes the upper band, and therefore makes a certain asymmetry when it comes to the small data limit.
Could you resolve those excitations into amplitudes that have to do with the charge and amplitudes with the spin, and then you can see whether they are dominantly hollons or spinners?
Sure, but in this picture, what I'm saying is that these are not. I mean, it's not.
You resolved it and you saw that.
Yeah. It's just essentially hole hopping on a dimer state.
Okay.
So this is still just the simple physics concerning the dominant poles. Now let me come to that. Of course, we can treat all the remaining of these terms, and I'm not going to say how that proceeds. There is some diagrammatic technique which treats the spin excitations and which treats the whole excitations, couples them together, and after turning some self-consistent diagrammatic crank, you can get a spectrum. Right? Essentially, just for those of you which are aware of these techniques, it's just like you have some kind of triplet excitation and some kind of whole excitation, and you calculate self-energies of that type with all six vertices possible, and you turn the crank self-consistently, and you consider one particle spectral functions. So you can do two things or three things with that. First of all, you can just look at them in the thermodynamic limit. Right? And this is essentially what you then get in the gap-full case. And this is always particle hole inverted, so the first electron removal state, good. I still have 2 minutes to go. Okay, so you can see that the first electron removal state, so these are just two spectral functions for two values of J over T along the Brillouin zone, plotted for a certain amount of K vectors. And you can see that if you are in the large J limit, there is the first electron removal state always shows a clearly and very strongly developed quasi-particle pole. You can show that at least with this diagrammatic method, there is always going to be a quasi-particle solution. Now there's a tiny gap to where the continuum starts, and the gap is not necessarily related to the spin gap. It is some other gap which scales with the spin gap, but it is there. So you have a real solution to the quasi-particle spectrum here. And then there is still the upper part of that band, which now, of course, is strongly broadened and washed out. And you can also see that there is some asymmetry going on. So the lower one is a little bit less dispersive than the upper one. Now, apart from that, looking at this in the thermodynamic limit, you can, of course, also say, let's see, how does this compare to the numerical stuff? So you do the same kind of calculation on a small system and compare with the small system calculation. And this is down here. So I just take, this is the data from Didier, Ogier, and Elbio, Takoto, and this is, so to speak, the this diagrammatic theory with holes hopping around and exciting spin excitations. And you can see that, I mean, there's at least qualitatively, these spectra agree, and as such that you have this upper band and the lower one. The quasi-particle weight decreases as you go from 0 to pi, and the lower one increases as you go from 0 to pi in the upper one. And you have some spectral weight in between. Obviously, we don't have the inelastic part of our scattering processes are not strong enough to decrease this as it is happening here. But on the other hand, if you draw a straight line here, there is more weight extending out than in our calculation. But qualitatively, this already, I think, explains what you see in the numerical data.
Totally, no doubt. I mean, I would still, you know, consistently argue that, you know, the delta is small and you put in enough energy, at some point, the electron should discover that it's actually two particles spin on how long?
I will.
Okay. I guess you're really saying that they're not particularly not visible in the electron spectral function, right? So the false sense of fact that the stages are electron by are big in point emission and it's been a whole space. So is that what you're saying?
Let me just put on this. I had this one view graph here where I was saying that.
How big delta, little delta?
Little delta here. Smaller than that little distance that you see here. Right? I mean, little delta, the dimerization parameter. Oh, that is on the order of half a percent or so. Very small, half a percent. Okay. Maybe you just wait until this last view graph that I wanted to put on. Okay, so here's this question. Okay, so here's this question. What is going to happen? What is going to happen to the quasi-particles once we start cranking on one of the parameters in the model, which will soften the spin excitations? There are other parameters, and I can show a figure for other parameters too, but let me just take this one where you, so to speak, make J very small. So you come to that limit where essentially you should somehow start to see that the quasi-particles are not well-defined anymore. But what I'm showing here is just a blow-up of the single-particle spectrum at one point in K-space where you can convince yourself that, if at all, the quasi-particle will exist always, which is actually pi over 2. And you look into that point, and you crank down J from some given value, J over T is equal to 1, to some small value, J over T is close to 0. And you look at how the quasi-particle weight for that single electron evolves as a function of J. And obviously, for J very small, we should somehow expect the system to be then non-Fermi liquid-like, or at least to behave very differently. And so what we then extract simply is we extract the quasi-particle weight from that single pole as we go along in J space. And as you can clearly see, the quasi-particle weight continuously goes down to 0. This last point I will mention in this figure down here, as J goes down to 0. So you can see how this quasi-particle picture is self-destructive once you start making J very small. This was one of the issues that I had on my second view graph. We wanted to know what happens to the quasi-particle as the model starts to get very soft in the spin wave excitations. You can say play the same game, not with J going to zero, but with the gap of the spin excitations going to zero. Finally, there's one point. This is this singular point down here. When J is equal to zero, then our model is something like just a J model with a fixed dimer background. And for that, you can calculate the spectral T model with a fixed dimer background. And of course, you can calculate the spectral function for that then within this framework too. And what you then have is what I'm showing here is the one particle spectral function for various values of K. And as you see, it has no pole left. So in essence, the system is down here at zero with the quasi-particle weight, and the spectrum is fully incoherent. And so in some sense, this connects to one of the questions that I was putting up front here. What happens as you tune on the parameters of the spin model with the single particle excitation? And what I'm telling you that as you, that I come from here and essentially am hitting this line here as the spin excitations get soft. And obviously, you can play similar games then with other parameters of the model, but I don't want to elaborate on that here. And I think I've used 16 minutes. Sorry for that.
Well, I guess Claudius is just going to raise a few issues and then maybe we can continue the discussion next week.
In terms of experimental data, so that links back to Jan Affleck's question, what kind of properties have this model? And he was talking in terms of the excitation spectrum. Another issue is in terms of transport properties. And this is a project we are just starting together with Vicente Alvarez, who's also in this workshop. So there have been some very nice, what I think, experiments on this famous compound copper germanate, with already more than 500 publications. So here's one more. So copper germanate has here 14 degree Kelvin at spin pi transition. So in the specific heat, that's the specific heat, there's a kind of jump. And what they have measured, there are other people who measured that last year, the thermal conductivity, and the idea is that it may be possible in this one-dimensional system to see a magnetic contribution to the thermal conductivity, which as far as I've heard from other experimentalists, it's extremely difficult in three-dimensional matters. Sorry? Yeah, that's one moment. That is constant D, the diffusion constant as a function of monomer temperature. And because normally the scattering length between spin waves is so short that you normally don't see that in three-dimensional magnets. And now, so this is here the thermal conductivity as measured, and we see that there's something going here on at the spin pi transition that means it's sensitive to the opening of the gap, and then it rises again. Now, the interpretation of this data is pretty difficult. I will come back to this picture. So I don't have any results to show. I'll just show you here the experiments. What happens in an applied magnetic field is pretty spectacular. I'm sorry. So that is the same thermal conductivity here at zero applied magnetic field. Now, if you apply a magnetic field, this lower peak is extremely sensitive. It nearly goes down up to here, 14 Tesla. And when you go up with the magnetic field again, it raises again. And that happens exactly at the transition commensurate to incommensurate. So that is here at 4 degree Kelvin as a function of magnetic field. Here that's this first order transition you talked about. And we see that the thermal conductivity goes down and then raises up again. So it's sensitive to this transition, which is of course also a crystallographic transition, but one might argue that it's sensitive to the magnetic excitation spectrum, because exactly here at the transition, of course, we have gapless magnetic excitation spectrum. So the authors of this paper indicated the following interpretation, which one might or might not agree, that this part here is a magnetic contribution coming from spin waves or spin-ons, whatever one has. Since one below the spin-pile transition, they die out. And this is a contribution to the thermal conductivity from phonons. Now, then you might think, why are phonons so sensible to the magnetic field? Because they scatter. There's a strong spin-phonon coupling here in this material. They scatter from the magnetic excitation. And when this, and here, there are no magnetic excitation because we have a gap. So the phonon part is strong. If you increase the magnetic field, the gap goes down, the scattering goes up, so the spin phonon scattering increases, so the thermal conductivity goes down. And so what we believe is, there are more experiments on these compounds with doping, there are more experiments on sodium vanadate and on ladder compounds. So we believe that the thermal conductivity is a good tool to maybe or not understand the transport properties of the elementary excitation of these systems and to see what singlet triplet, whatever.
Is this a unique material in which you have such a dramatic shape in conductivity?
So in magnetic field, yes. But in sodium vanadate, which is also a kind of spin piles, maybe not, system, has essentially the same structure. It's going up. At the transition temperature, it's going down, going up again. But there, the magnetic field dependence is not so strong, but also the spin pipes.
The location of peak should somehow relate to the body temperature of the lattice, right?
Well, no.
The story is that at low frequency, at low temperature, you start excite phonons, but they don't group-clock scatter.
Yeah.
Right? And then when the characteristic momentum of phonons gets an order of the group-clock factor, you start to dissipate. Right?
Yeah, but
you get more and more phonons.
Yeah, but the issue is a little bit
more.
Well, in some sense, but one has to be, of course, aware that in a perfect crystal, this translation, an infinite perfect crystal, this translation invariant, the thermal conductivity of the phonons is infinite at zero temperature, like for electrons. So the reason that phonons go to zero at finite temperature is because of impurities or because they scatter at the surface.
It's elastic scattering.
Yeah.
Right?
So that is, and therefore, it depends on the quality of the
is due to inelastic.
It's to umklapp. Yeah. That the phonons go down at high temperatures due to umklapp. So that's where the peak is exactly.
It's
in this sense, not so
not a not a order of the body temperature. Yeah. Get around that. So is it
no,
pretty low?
No, no. The body temperature is much higher.
It's
no,
higher,
no.
Right? So it's
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I understand that, but there are scales, right?
Yeah.
Umklapp is a scale. The umklapp is a scale that we are.
The speed velocity is relevant, right? When you get enough K, you can have
yeah, I agree.
Well, you can see that, for example, so if you look at the, I mean this, if you look at the doped crystal, which is, so if you dope that with magnesium, this is one here, doped with magnesium, then you kill that one, but you kill both of them. So that's somehow. So if you dope it with magnesium, you kill both parts of because of the scattering. And then also, of course, the magnetic field effect. There's still a magnetic field effect, but it is much smaller. I think that's, I said a few words and of.
And the lowest temperature, is there a power law? After all this second
yes.
Drop and then you rise again and you drop and then and what
yeah.
Is there? Is this, yeah.
I guess so. I don't know which power it is.
Is it
I don't know which power it is. Is it linear or second? Yeah, but I don't know which power it is. It must be some power above it because it's four and four. It's elastic scattering, but I don't know which linear problem. Yeah. So I think copper germinate is a kind of word by itself. I mean, there's this transport phenomena, there's this commensate, incommensate, there's this doping phenomena, so that's. Many people can talk about copper germinate and talk about completely different things. So, that's
okay,
it.
So maybe we'll continue the discussion on spin pile system next week. And also, for those who came in late, Claudius' talk on Thursday will be also moved to next week.